You probably think that you know of every big-time radio and TV star in America. Oh, wrong again. Here comes the Colonel.
Yes. We have to share the studio with a comedy group down the hall. They keep sneaking in here, making snide remarks. All right, welcome back. The second half of The Promise of Tomorrow here on the Science News Radio Network. I'm your host. I'm Colonel Mason. We're going to get back to Jack Tazaza in just a minute. He has written the book called Superpower on the Nation's Electrical Grid. The National Academy of Engineering called the development of our national electrical grid the most important technical development of the 20th century, and the Engineers Association said Jack Tazaza is largely responsible for that. Before we go any further, let's step over to our fountain of useless information we have here on the set.
Welcome to the fountain of useless information. How can I help you?
Yes, once again, I see we have aroused the spirit of the fountain by throwing in the coins. All right, oh, spirit of the fountain, here's a word game for you. Tell us, what does a phobophobe fear? A lot of P's in that one. A phobophobe. What does a phobophobe fear, oh, wise spirit of the fountain? Tell us that one.
I have given you my answer, and now you may tell the others.
I cannot fool the spirit of the fountain. A phobophobe. It's kind of kind of redundant, isn't it? A phobophobe fears fear. That's right. All right. Back to our guest today, Jack Tazaza. And more fascinating history on the United States electrical grid.
People at a board level are concerned with what will this do to our system, to our company, to our earnings, to our ability to provide safe wages and our ability to provide the necessary capital to build a system. So, well, I was trying to say it should appeal to all levels, lawyers, engineers, and probably faculty, the educators, probably more than the others. But I'm sure there are a lot of people in public who will be very interested in reading Superpower. I think they'll find it interesting because one of the things I tried to do, Colonel, was there were things that were meetings I sat in on, which never been publicized, what happened and why, that I have recorded in the book. I wanted to tell the story, what really happened. I wanted to tell the truth and have people know what happened and learn from it. That was my objective, as I said before.
Well, it sounds like a fascinating read and a laborious work, and I wonder, can you tease us a little bit with maybe an anecdote about one of the situations where the decision was made that was wrong and caused a problem later on? Can you bring anything to mind, quickly?
Well, I'll tell you one. Federal Power Commission, who wrote regulations as to how these systems were used, had issued an NOPR, N-O-P-R, Notice of Public Review, new ways to dispatch generation and run generation, which was going to save the public a lot of money, they claimed. So there's a public hearing. Some of us who read the regulation didn't think it was going to save a penny. They thought it was going to make things more complicated and difficult. You know, we're still arguing at the presidential front about regulation. Well, this regulation, we thought, was going to make it bad for the power systems and power system customers. When power systems costs increase, their customers' costs increase. Well, simultaneously, the federal government had to put out an environmental impact statement, which would say whether this change would cause any environmental impacts will be undesirable. It's about a 300-page statement. Well, some of us read this statement, environmental impact statement, and in it it said that this regulation would have no environmental impact. Why? Because it would not change how generators were operated. This is right on top of another department in the government arguing that it was going to reduce the cost of operating the generator significantly. So obviously there were things that contradicted each other. Some of us went to the hearing on this and cited how the government had contradicted each other. Well, the net result of this is the chief economist for the government resigned in 3 days. And some of us made some comments at the meeting that it's about time the federal government got competent people to do this work. But there's an example.
But in all actuality, the whole electrical grid in our modern-day electrical system never really could have been developed without a lot of help from the government. Isn't that correct?
The government had to do some things, but exactly what they did, I think the establishment of TVA was a good thing. I know a lot of private companies didn't like TVA because TVA was going to generate power and it was going to use this this power. So the companies in the surrounding area thought Wendell Weekly owned was chairman of one of them, felt that this power would take business away from them. The second thing was, if the government built all these dams for TVA, they'd have to get the power out. They had to work with the utilities to deliver the utilities had to, over the utilities transmission line, had to deliver the power. Legislation had been passed in Washington that said if the utilities would not deliver the power for TVA, that the TVA government could build its own lines. But what this led to is essentially cooperation between the government and the utilities. Where the government owned power plants, that was something where they had to coordinate the power plant operation, how the power was gotten out, how it was delivered, who was delivered to. They had to work together under some of the leaders in the government, but they worked successfully. One of them I admired very, very much was Joseph Swidler, who I discuss in the book quite a bit. He was a lawyer who was power attorney for TVA. I tried to show the areas where working the government and private enterprise works, and that if the government tries to be strong arm the situation and take over and hurt, and the private enterprise think they're going to be hurt, it doesn't work. I try to explain how it can work. I will not say that the government was really instrumental to establishing the grid. Was established by the private company substantially, but the government exercised control. It's like a football game. The private companies played the game. The government was the referee and it made sure that abuses to the public did not occur, and that was good. The way that was done, it was a case of Insel, who, as he establishes these companies, GE and Commonwealth Edison, made fortunes. He had, I believe, something like $500 million worth of assets with a $27 million investment. That's a nice investment for $27 million. And was making a large, large amount of money. The Roosevelt administration came in and began to think that this ownership of, Insel did this by acquiring and buying companies. He bought them up and had more and more and more of them. And he got to the point where he was really a power baron. Roosevelt felt that this was an abuse of the public. And when TVA was established, and then later on the PJM Power Pool was established, everybody began to realize that ownership of a large, excessive amount of assets was not essential. What was essential is contracts between the various owning facilities to operate them in coordination, whether the other facility was a government or another company or another pool. What it led to was probably, at this point I would like to make, probably led to 100 years of cooperation. Cooperation became the theme of what we had to do to build this network. And government oversaw to make sure the power operation was not abusive.
Cooperation, yes, absolutely. We hear that a lot, that there has to be compromise and cooperation. Of course, we should say, for the listeners who don't know what we're talking about, the TVA is the Tennessee Valley Authority, and that was a series of dams and other electrical generating areas that the government had pioneered, put in back during the middle of the previous century. Now, I've got to ask you, Jack, a lot of countries are not never had a power grid, don't plan to have a power grid, and are operating going totally without it. And there are those who are saying that the American power grid is antiquated, that it is expensive to maintain, that it is open to attacks, terrorist attacks, and, of course, the weather knocking down the power lines, and that the whole thing is antiquated technology, and we need to go to we need to get out of the power grid altogether, quit worrying about a smart grid, and go to localized power sources. Do you see that? Do you feel that?
Oh, I think that's impossible. The key thing, that's why you got to go back and look at why we started out with localized power sources, 1915 book. Why did they connect them together? They were making savings, huge savings. They reduced the cost of electricity over 20 years to half. There are economic benefits. Part of the reason they're economic benefits, there's something we call diversity. You have a power system, Colonel and I have one. Your power system peaks in the summer, mine peaks in the winter. That means that there are times in the you have the excess generation because your peak isn't there, and I other times I have mine. If we interconnect, we can reduce the amount of generating capacity we have to build. Because when my peak occurs, yours will not occur, and you can help me out. So there's when a question of efficiency. If you are burning a fuel that has one cost and I have a fuel of another cost, and your fuel is lower than mine at a certain particular time, you should generate the power and sell it to me, and vice versa. I should say the savings from change in economic dispatch, the change in diversity of peak load and capital cost, all of these things will be lost if you go to individual grids. That's why they were connected. Now, in connecting them, and let me make one other point. When you connect to them, those of us who are involved with connecting them to make the grid saw the benefits. One of the disadvantages of connecting them, which we're aware of, is when trouble happens one place, because someplace else is connected to it, you can drag the other place down. The analogy I like to use is like mountain climbing. You get a mountain climber, and you get five or six people rope themselves together in case one slips, they don't fall. That was the purpose of interconnecting the grids. But what happens occasionally when there have been bad errors made, and the problem is to reduce these, all six of the climbers went down because the first few who went dragged the others. So by being interconnected, you have benefits and you have problems, and it, like the mountain climbers do. But there's no question that being interconnected has benefits overall, net benefits that are very significant. The ties, there was a study made by Joseph Swindler that showed about 1960, $12 billion a year saving from the interconnections between systems. By 1985, it was $25 billion a year being saved. That's the fuel cost and capital investment cost. You do not make these savings. You have individual systems. You have to be able to have one system help the other. The cooperation between the systems was what some of these early people found. And superpower spends most of its time talking about the cooperation between the systems.
Well, of course, we've had the Eastern grid and the Western grid and the Texas grid. Now all those grids, we understand, are going to be coming together in New Mexico at Tres Amigos. And how do you feel about that? Do you see that's a benefit?
They're interconnected now. Like the Eastern grid is connected with the Midwestern grid by AC, but then the Midwestern grid is connected with Texas, with DC, and California is connected with up on British Columbia with DC. There are two ways to connect. This is what people have to look at. If you connect them with AC, AC has the characteristic that anything that happens at any one point on a system affects the entire AC system and network. It's a single machine, as I said before. One network is a single machine, and if you lose a generator in New York, a 1,000 megawatt unit in New York, you will see it on your charts in Florida. you'll see the effect on us, our effects frequency, affects how power flows. So that AC has problems. Some of us have argued that we should take the four AC systems, which we've got basically, you just name them, and divide them maybe into nine AC systems. But don't lose the value of the interconnections. Interconnect them with DC. Why? Because DC does not transfer the energy and power like the AC does. You can set a control on the DC to maintain a specific flow on the line. With AC, the flow on the line is not controllable. So you have to, I'm not going to say that you shouldn't have a small system, but a number of systems interconnected by DC, perhaps 9 or 12, should be looked at by the government in the future. The government is not sponsoring this kind of thing. The government, unfortunately, is very heavily manned by lawyers and economists, and they are concerned with what the rule book says. Lawyers, I love lawyers, but their mind works as what does the law say and how do we implement it? They don't ask themselves, is this the right law? How could this be? I think we need far more engineering expertise in this making the setting policies for the future.
This would be a good time, Jack, to ask you to put on the meditation cap for just a minute and look into the future somewhere or other and give us a prediction. What do you see 5 years, 10 years, 50 years down the line, maybe long after you and I are gone? What do you see in the future?
Some of us, back, I will tell you, Colonel, as far back as 50 years ago, asked what was the system going to be like. And we guessed pretty good. The thing that we didn't anticipate was some of the changes in environmental requirements and some of the changes in digital technology, computers and that sort of thing. The question I have to ask and answer that question, what's the future in this technology on the power systems? What's the future of the technology of the systems like computers and so on, other systems? I don't think anybody in 1940 anticipated what digital computers are doing now on the internet. I don't know if we can say that's true in the future. But I would say that the key thing is going to be, will we continue to cooperate between various elements of the system, or will we shift away from it as we've done recently to competition? Competition became the golden ball that we're all after. Competition does not lead to developing the best technology, in my imagination. I think competition is good, but it has to be shrouded in cooperation. So 20 years from now, I would say we're going to need, in order to use our resources like solar and wind and so on, which are schedulable, or which are not schedulable. You can't schedule when you get the power from a solar power line. You can't schedule when you get it from a wind thing. And when you need it, it may be a completely different time from when it's available. So the net result is that the solar power, if you put 100 megawatts of solar power in, it's only worth about 20 megawatts when you need it. That's what you got to recognize. Now, what is it worth when I need it? Not what does it say on the nameplate. And it's the same thing is true with wind. How do you solve this problem? Energy storage. I think this is where I'm coming to for the future. I don't think there's any question that energy storage could make quite a difference on our power systems if we can get it, because then we can operate the full solar system. We put in a 100 megawatt plant. We can operate 100 megawatts. If we don't need a full 100 megawatts, only need 20, you put the rest of it in storage and use it later when you do need it, reducing the amount of solar you need. So energy storage is the key factor in the future, as I see it, Colonel. The other factor is transportation. Transportation is a huge energy consumer. How we will move our people around, how I'm going to go around with my car, how my others in the area, railroads. Well, what are we going to do for transportation? I think that there's no question that we cannot continue your users of oil. We need to increase our own use of oil, but we cannot continue using so much oil for transportation with the automobile. I think the answer on that is going to be electric vehicles. Right now, they're difficult. I drove an electric vehicle 20 years ago for 3 months and broke three springs because of the weight of the batteries hitting a pothole. There are problems with the electric vehicles. I know what's going on with the manufacturers of Volt and so on. But I think the future lies in use of electricity to help power our electric vehicles. And the combined electric power thing, you know, the plug-in type car and energy storage can be worked into the smart grid to meet future needs and work it into perhaps changes in the grid size and put some DC in would be the way we'll go in the future.
All right, Jack, how about a word of wisdom, some life lesson that that you'd like to be remembered by or you'd like to impart at this particular time? Give us words to live by. What do you say?
If you can remember from one of the things I said, is it's important to recognize that cooperation in the industry, the cooperation with the government, the cooperation between companies, leads to faster, better technology and benefits the public. We are throwing away competition by some of the things we're doing with legislation and under the guise of cooperation by some of the things we're doing, supposedly to implement competition. Remember that competition was the key to what we got done over 100 years. If you ask me for one word, it's competition. And I think we should learn from that for the future.
All right, Jack Cazaza, the author of Superpower. His publisher, Tate Publishing, says is historically accurate, telling the story of the 20th century and those who put the technical pieces together to form the world's best electric power system. You've been a fascinating guest. We're dying to read your book, and it's so good of you to be with us today. I want to thank you so sincerely.
Thank you very much, Colonel. It's a pleasure.
And at this time, I want to thank you very much for those of you who have contributed to this program. We depend on contributions from listeners like you for the existence of this show. We're totally science community supported. So those of you who have contributed, thank you very much. Those of you who wish to can do so at our website, promiseoftomorrow.biz. On the right-hand side of your screen, you'll see a little tab there for donations. Just click the donations, and we appreciate all your help.
And now, we make time for the voice of reason. Listener comments, ideas, and suggestions.
I often use the Winston Churchill line when I talk to students about adding to the body of knowledge and contributing back to society. And I think Prime Minister Churchill said something like this, we make a living by what we do, but we make a life by what we give. And so we expect our graduates, whether they be bachelor's students, master's, or doctorates, to contribute back to them body of knowledge, to make a difference. And lifelong learning is the key to that. You never stop learning. You're never too old to continue learning. And that's what we stand for here with adult learners. My name is Dr. Raymond Gillette. I serve as the Dean of Academic Affairs and Student Services at the National Graduate School of Quality Management, located in Falmouth, Massachusetts.
So you decide, has this really been the voice of reason? Listener comments are welcome at 214-329-4949. And please tell us your name and where you're from.
You've been listening to The Promise of Tomorrow with Colonel Mason, the definitive program on emerging and nanotechnologies, now archived and streamed on the web at promiseoftomorrow.biz. Join us next week at the same time as we learn more about the promise of tomorrow.
You live tomorrow, 'cause you know what will be there. I am waiting for you. I am waiting. see to you.